The first phase of the Iran-Contra hearings has given us a fuller picture of American efforts to free the hostages in Lebanon. The fate of my guests was bound up in that intrigue. On September 14th of 1985, Reverend Benjamin Weir was released by the Islamic Jihad after 16 months of captivity in Lebanon. He was one of three Americans released after secret American arms shipments to Iran. Carol Weir witnessed her husband's kidnapping, but was powerless to stop it. The Weirs had worked in Lebanon for 30 years as Presbyterian missionaries. They spoke fluent Arabic and felt at ease with the Muslim culture. They regarded Beirut as their home and didn't want to leave, in spite of the dangers they risked in staying. After her husband's kidnapping, Carol Weir devoted herself to securing his freedom. The Weirs have written an account of their ordeal. It's titled Hostage Bound, Hostage Free, and it's published by Westminster Press. When I spoke to them, I asked Benjamin Weir to describe the moment he was kidnapped.
We had just stepped out of our apartment house, going toward the seminary just 10 minutes away. I was thinking about the meeting I was going to and hardly noticed that a car had stopped on the narrow street, but I did see a man come toward me, and I thought probably he was a stranger asking for directions and maybe speaking English. So I asked him, do you want something? He said, yes, I want you. I thought his English was all mixed up until he grabbed my arm and started pulling me toward the car. And that was, a sign to me that this was a kidnap attempt. I started yelling and resisting and trying to fight him off, but he was a lot bigger and stronger than I was and finally forced me into the back seat. And when I was seated and he next to me, then a man in the front turned around and pointed a pistol at me and said, get down on the floor. I realized at that moment there was no way to escape, I could see, and that I really was being taken, and I had no idea what would happen. I was frightened and startled.
Benjamin Weir, they had you in the car, and you were all tied up. Describe what they did to you in the car.
Well, in the car, I was told and forced down onto the floor of the back seat, and then a piece of burlap or something was put over the top of me, but the man next to me in the back seat kept his hand right on my back so he knew every move I made. The car sped on and finally came to a halt. When it did, a bag was put over my head and I was led out of the car into a room. There I was made to lie down face down on a mattress, blindfolded, while hands went through my pockets, going through everything I had. And then I was turned over and felt tape being, and heard tape being stripped from a roll and felt it being wound around my ankles and up over my body with my hands pinned to my side, right to the top of my head, with just enough space to breathe through my nose. That was a frightening experience because I wasn't sure I could continue to breathe without having enough air passage, or I wondered what would happen if my nose passage should get clogged. I did ask for some water, and they gave me a sip of water through some kind of a funnel and then taped my mouth again closed, though I was not gagged. And then I felt myself being lifted and put in a container and heard the lid close. And I was glad then that I could still breathe.
Did you ever ask your captors why they wanted you, why they kidnapped you?
Yes, I did. When I was taken, before I was completely taped, and the men said, for political reasons. I said, what political reasons? I'm not involved in any political activity. I'm a pastor. They said, well, you'll find out eventually. And that ambiguity continued for about 2 months.
And what did you find out about why they had taken you?
Well, at the end of 2 months, one day, a man came and said I was to write a letter. And he dictated in Arabic what I was to say, putting it in English. It was kind of a crazy letter because he gave it to me word by word and phrase by phrase so that it came out in kind of stilted unnatural English. But before I got to the end of the letter, I realized this was a letter in which I was making an appeal to the Prince of Kuwait for release of men held there, and that what happened with them would happen with me. If they were released, I'd be released. If they were continued to be detained, I would. Or if they were killed, I'd be killed. That was a very sobering and frightening prospect. I really was very much surprised by it.
Carol, the burden was on you to do everything you humanly could to get your husband released, but this is not something people have a lot of experience with. Did you panic? Were you able to kind of keep yourself mentally organized enough to logically figure out what you should be doing?
Well, of course, I was very upset and really didn't know what to do. I went to my friends, to the seminary, where there were people who were supportive of me and helpful. I knew that I needed to go to the American Embassy to report what had happened. And I think that knowing I had to just proceed and do those things gave me the energy to follow through on them.
Did you call the press?
At first, I asked the Synod of Syria and Lebanon executive to make a statement to the press identifying who Ben was and the fact that we were related to that church activity. And at first I was very reluctant to go to the press. I had been told by embassy personnel not to go to the media, not to say much, and not to talk and so on. But then my friend said, maybe the persons who took Ben don't know who he is or what his work has been. And so then I did talk to the press and had an interview to identify him, what his work was, how we were related, what we were doing in the Middle East, what we were doing in Lebanon. And I think perhaps it was that article that identified for Ben's captors who he was and what his work was.
It seems that probably one of the key things you have to do if you are someone who has taken somebody hostage is to make sure that you don't empathize with them. Because if you empathize with them, if you really recognize their humanity, then you'd be overcome by guilt and would want to set them free. Were there ways that you realized that the captors were dehumanizing you so that they wouldn't have to face your humanity?
Well, I was kept isolated for 14 months and rarely had much in the way of conversation with my captors. There were a few occasions where that happened, but mostly conversation was very limited, was superficial, was related to a specific thing such as bringing food or taking me to the bathroom or some mechanical thing of that kind. And otherwise, their remarks were often silly, not really very much related to the real situation. Furthermore, they never wanted to be recognized and was never allowed to see them. I was always blindfolded in their presence. And from my side, I never really trusted them fully. I was rather reserved, especially at the beginning, so that there wasn't really very much interpersonal communication. And that was a real setback. I did very early hope that I might establish some kind of relationship with them, even in teaching them English, but that never really happened.
You weren't tortured.
No.
What were the most humiliating things, though, to suffer in captivity?
Well, there were a few occasions where I was really at risk. At one time, the first guard who was in charge of me for several weeks was very brusque and very controlling. He was very determined that I should not in any way even approach seeing him, and therefore insisted that I would always keep my blindfold on even when he was not present. On one occasion, I had been clearing my nose, and just when he unlocked the door, and as he came in, he found me settling my blindfold back in place, and he was very irate over that. He said, "I'm going to show you." So he went out. I could hear him taking his pistol out. I thought probably he was emptying the bullets, but I couldn't be sure. And when he came back in, he poked the barrel of the pistol under my chin, and he said, "I could very easily blow your head off." And he said, "You know what this means?" I said, "Yes, you're thinking about the fact that you could kill me." He said, "Yes, and don't forget it." He said, "I could easily kill you and throw your body out in the road. Nobody would ever ask about it." I thought he was doing that only to scare me. I didn't really think he intended to kill me, but I realized the possibility was there. That was one frightening experience.
Yeah, it seems every time you peeked out of the window when you were told not to look out, or every time you took off a blindfold, every time you were told to leave it on, even though you were alone in the room, that you were risking some terrible punishment for
it.
And it must have been a really hard decision to make, whether it was worth the risk or not.
It was, but I finally came to the point of realizing I was willing to take that risk in order to just get some kind of sense of what the outside was like, as well as to get some idea of where I was being held. And I took that risk, knowing there was a real risk to it. But I felt it was worthwhile, and it certainly gave me some memories when I had seen a sunset or a sunrise, or in the middle of the night seen some stars, that, you know, it was an image I could carry with me through the rest of the day, and it meant a great deal to me.
What were some of the other things that you could think about or do to help you get through the day? I'd imagine that boredom and lack of any kind of mental stimulation is one of the worst things to face when you're being held hostage.
Very much so. I had been involved in enough pastoral counseling to know what depression does to someone, and I didn't want to fall into depression. So I felt from the very beginning I ought to try to take charge as much as I could and establish some kind of an agenda. I exercised regularly many different times during the day, partly just to use up the time. I also engaged in fantasy trips intentionally. I had birthday parties for my children or for family members. I wrote imaginary letters to them. I also regularly had times of meditation, trying to recall a specific Bible passage and to really study it and try to see what it had to say to me. Later on, when I finally, after 35 days, was given an Arabic New Testament, then I engaged in very serious study of Scripture and came up with a lot of new questions, as well as very meaningful passages that spoke to me.
Was your faith ever shaken?
I felt from the very first that my faith was very frail, and I didn't know how long I could last. I really felt that I needed to rely on God to give me a sense of trust and dependence on Him, and more relied upon the expectation and the promise that God gives His Holy Spirit to those who really ask and trust for it. And I felt that was true, that I was given resources beyond my own. And in other ways, God made available to me resources within me that I was not aware of.
I'm surprised to hear you say that you thought that your faith was frail.
I think that probably is true for everyone in a desperate circumstance. I think it's only realistic to recognize it, and that one of the passages of the New Testament presents it, when we are weak, then we begin to sense the strength of God. I think that's a very important human experience that comes to us again and again.
Carol Weir, when you first started trying to talk with U.S. government officials about your husband's captivity, they told you to go for what, quiet diplomacy?
Well,
was that the word that they used?
Do yes. They were using quiet diplomacy, and that the church's task was to pray, but that they were going ahead with quiet diplomacy. Yes, that's the phrase that was used most often with me.
Did you try that for a while? Because they wanted you to not speak to the press a lot, too, right? Wasn't that part of the quiet diplomacy?
Well, that's right. And I did decide that I would not go to the press. I informed our church people that they should not put anything in the press or go to the media or do a lot of talking and so on about Ben's situation. After a few months, I began to have some questions about that, though.
Why?
Well, I, for one thing, was continuing in contact with the embassy in Beirut, and I had no sense of progress on the case. The same language was being used with me over and over again. It takes a long time, and we're trying, and so on, but I didn't have a sense of any progress. And we met in Damascus because it wasn't safe for Americans to be traveling in Beirut. And we visited the American ambassador there. And I pressed him as to what our government was really doing for the release of Ben and the others. And his response to me was, "Have you been to Washington?" That and other clues made me realize that I probably needed to return to the United States and to be more active in Washington for Ben's release.
You tried to get an audience with President Reagan?
Yes, I did. I tried to get an appointment with him. I was told that he was too busy to see us.
Who were you able to speak with in the government?
We spoke with Richard Murphy, the Undersecretary of State for the Middle East, and we did get an appointment with Mr. Schultz, the Secretary of State. I talked with him, but I was rather discouraged after our meeting because, again, I had a sense of no progress, you know, a sense of helplessness. What do you expect us to do? What can we do in this situation? So I really had the sense that there was no one person, for example, who headed up the effort to get the men released, that the whole question was handled rather broadly in their efforts at counterterrorism. That was one reason I was discouraged. Another was that I was pressing them for contact with Kuwait about the prisoners that were being held there. And they said they would not interfere with another government, that that was Kuwait's affair. And then I pressed them to be in touch with the men that held Ben and the others, and they said they would not deal with terrorists. So it seemed to me they were not really doing those things that I felt would unlock the issue and get the men out.
So you tried to take matters more into your own hands? To be more aggressive in campaigning for his freedom?
Yes, that's true. I decided that, and along with our church people, that we would have our own campaign. And so I began to appear in the media. I discovered when I returned to the United States that not many people knew about the hostage affair, that it had been kept quiet. And I felt that the American people needed to know and that they would express compassion and that there would be a desire for the men to be released.
My guests are Reverend Benjamin Weir and Carol Weir. Benjamin Weir was a hostage in Lebanon taken by Shiite captors. He was hostage from May 8, 1984 to September 14th of 1985. Benjamin and Carol Weir have collaborated on a book about that hostage experience. It's titled Hostage Bound, Hostage Free. This is Fresh Air. Reverend Benjamin Weir and Carol Weir are my guests. They've collaborated on a new book titled Hostage Bound, Hostage Free. Benjamin Weir, when you were released, how did they tell you that you were going to be set free?
Well, it happened very suddenly. One evening, the chief of the guards came to me and said, "We've decided you're going to go." I said to him, "I think Father Martin Jenko probably needs to be released more than I do because he has high blood pressure." But the chief of the guards would not even enter into any discussion of that. He said, "One of the guards will trim your beard, you'll take a shower, and you'll go." I had two reactions. One was, "Yes, I very much want to be free." The other was, "Oh God, what can I do in behalf of the other men? I couldn't think that I could do anything for them."
It's just hard to imagine this opportunity. Someone says, "Okay, you're going to be free," and you say, no. I think Father Jenko, you should free him instead. What did you think, Carol, when you found out that your husband had almost objected to his own release and suggested somebody else should be released
upset.
Instead? Were you?
I was.
Well, she was angry. She didn't really like the idea at all.
Well, Ben had been held the longest, and we were, as hostage families, concerned together for all the men. And everything we did for Ben, we always said we intended and tried to make an effort for all the men to be freed. But if there was only one to be freed, I felt that Ben should be that one.
It must have been hard, I guess, to leave you. There were several other men who you had been in a room with.
It was
the
very
last
hard.
Part
we
of your
we
captivity.
Had been together for the better part of 2 months, and we had really become very, very close. There was barely opportunity for me to hug each of them in a very tearful way and to say goodbye. And then I was led out blindfold down the stairs to a car into the back seat and driven perhaps something like 20 or 25 minutes, and then told from the man in the front seat, we're going to stop in a minute. When we do, you're to get right out, leave your blindfold behind, don't look back, and you'll know where you are. And that's the way it happened.
So where were you?
I was on a street in Beirut in the middle of the night. I knew where I was.
No one to meet you?
Oh,
no one there?
No, no. It was spooky. There was nobody on the street.
Did you ever think, oh, somebody else doesn't come and kidnap me while I'm trying to get home?
No, I really didn't think of that, but I knew that, nobody is on the streets of Western Beirut at night.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous. People have guns. There are firefights that can break out at a moment's notice. No, my thought was, somebody might just not know who's there and take a pot shot at him, and I could be that target.
But you made it. Where'd you go?
I really don't want to talk much about that, but I went to friends, and they put me in touch with the American Embassy.
Were you debriefed? Was there a period in which you were told what kind of information to give to the media and to the public and what to withhold?
Oh, no. No, there was nothing of that kind. But the following day, I agreed with a member of our program agency of our church to meet with people from the government, from State Department, and others for a series of sessions, and did. But early on that day, I received a phone call from a Navy operator who said the president was on Air Force One plane and would like to talk to me. And so I said, fine, and waited. He said, you'll have to remember that there are some security regulations, and therefore you're not to address the president, but to use only his code name, which is Rawhide. And I thought that was strange and determined that I really wasn't going to do it because it really sounded pretty silly to me. Finally, the president came on the phone. He expressed his great thanks that I was free, his concern for the other hostages, his hope that there might still be others released, his hope that there would be no public announcement at this time. And I agreed that if that were for the safety and the hopeful release of other hostages, I certainly wanted that. So he pretty much continued. He was really carrying on the conversation. And finally, I realized I wasn't going to get a chance, so I broke in and said, I have a message from my captors of two parts, one that they expect the United States to put pressure on Kuwait for release of the 17 men held there, and secondly, they want you to know that they're ready to resolve this matter quietly, without publicity. I was surprised there was no response. The president, after the briefest of pauses, went on and finally said goodbye and hung up.
So he just stuck with his pre-written speech?
I thought maybe he was reading from a script. I couldn't tell, but it seemed that way.
What were your reactions when you found out that America had traded arms for hostages? And one of those arms shipments happened, was it a week or two before your release, Benjamin Weir?
I very much regret that there were arms involved because for years I've been opposed to the arms escalation in the Middle East, as has our church, and know what the cost is of modern arms. I have known friends to be killed. I know what it is to be on the end of an artillery barrage, and I regret that this has added to the loss of life in the Iran-Iraqi war.
Carol Weir, do you feel slightly ambivalent about it, sharing your husband's feeling that it's unfortunate that there would be more arms in the Middle East now? But on the other hand, he's released.
Oh, well, I don't feel ambivalent at all. I feel angry. I believe that there's always an alternative to military intervention. And I believe the way to go is to negotiate. And that was what we as hostage families were trying to get our government to do. So it was a great disappointment.
The government stand is that if you negotiate with hostage takers, then you're legitimizing them and you're making it more worth it for future groups to take people as hostages.
Well, in fact, they made a deal. They made a deal with Iran. That was never the demand of the group. They never asked for weapons. They never asked for ransom. What they wanted was prisoner exchange.
This is a painful thing to bring up, but I know you lost your 24-year-old daughter after your release, and she was killed in a bus accident, a train collided with the bus. It seems like more than any family should be put through. And I just can't imagine if the hostage period didn't shake your faith, what happened to your faith after a short time afterwards your daughter was taken away?
Well, that was a great loss, and I'm still in mourning for her. I think I have struggled with that, and there are no good answers. I realize that we as Christians are not entitled to special treatment, actually. We are subject to the accidents and the problems and the tragedies that occur to everyone, to anyone, and have prayed that I would have the courage and strength to bear that loss.
It's been the hardest thing we have ever faced. And in the midst of it, two things have come to me. It doesn't take away the loss, but one is that God suffers with us in that loss, and secondly, we are greatly blessed by the support of a Christian community that understands and really shares with us in that loss.
Okay, I want to thank you both very much for talking
thank
with
you.
Us.
You're welcome.
My guests have been Benjamin and Carol Weir. They recount Reverend Benjamin Weir's captivity in Lebanon and Carol's efforts to free him in their book Hostage Bound, Hostage Free. It's published by Westminster Press. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with playwrights Larry Kramer and William Hoffman. Their plays The Normal Heart and As Is explore how AIDS and the fear of AIDS are affecting not only sexual relations, but all relationships. So I hope you can join us.